For us, what's important is to begin to remember. Notice how the function of memory takes precedence over the function of imagination. The art of memory. Imagination is important on the mythic level. Extremely important on the mythic level. The mythic level is not healthy unless the imagination is functioning. But in history, it's memory that needs to function. The thought process needs memory to function in a healthy fashion. Just like feeling needs imagination to function healthy. If someone does not have the freedom of their imagination, their whole feeling tone is going to be crimped and inarticulate. You have to free the imagination to restore feeling to health. And just so, you have to educate the memory in order for thought to have its health. And imagination and memory go together. I guess we're beyond it. I almost thought of the words of the old Frank Sinatra song, Love and Marriage. Another time. Imagination and memory go together in this way. Feeling and thought go together in this way. But where do imagination and feeling function together in a harmony? Only when the deep self continuity occurs. Only then does the imagination function in such a way that memory is accurate. But memory is not the same as imagination. You don't remember what imagination brings up in terms of its referent. The referent for imagination is always nature. But the referent for memory is always the deep self. In Dante's great theory of poetry 800 years ago, he brought up again something that had been lost for hundreds of years in the Western tradition, that imagination can be anything but must be based upon nature. Then it has its beauty. But memory has a sublime aspect because its referent comes back to the deep self, to the integration of the meaning of all images. Imagination, when it's looked at in a structure, is an image base. Not just images, but an image base. There's not just a myth or mythic figures in a myth, but a mythology. And a mythology is like an ecology of all of these myths of this family structure that go together, the whole family. And so the image base is the rim of the circle of the integration. And its functioning way is to pull together, to be together, to come together. And as that image base comes together, the sense of presence occurs. And one simply is. But that presence is dynamic. And like any dynamism, not only has the pulse that comes together, but has the impulse that takes the togetherness and radiates it out. That's where the donut comes from, that radiation. And the radiation is the field, the energy field within which memory functions. So that if you look for the real root in memory, the real root is the deep self. Hence the hermetic maxim, remember who you are. What is the first orientation? To remember who you are. What is the worst of all possible worlds? To forget who you are. The beginnings of hell is the boundary of the river Lethe, the river of forgetfulness. When you cross the Lethe, you get into the beginnings of hell. Ignorance is forgetting. So that to remember who you are is a golden thread indeed of continuity. Because in remembering who you are, in a concomitant way, you remember who everyone else is too. It's inescapable. And the more you come to understand that you can remember who you are, you come to understand that everyone can come to remember who they are. The whole valuation of what a person is shifts from what you can count in this world to what you can count in all possible worlds, even those which are invisible and cannot be seen or manifested here in this time-space. Those worlds also count. So when we come to our mandala again, and we look at history and myth, and we saw that ritual and art are related, we see in just the same way that science and symbol are related. Spirit and self are a continuity. That's the importance of this mandala. This mandala is a compass for being. You can navigate. You can navigate the ocean of this world with this compass, if you know how to use this. You can become a mariner, not only in this planet in this world, but in any planet in this world realm. This compass can go anywhere. Anywhere that you can see or can imagine. And even places that you can't see and can't imagine. It's a compass for a very large civilization. And it works because it does work. That you don't see any crossed fingers here. The science is related to the symbol in our educational process. Science and symbol are related. Self and spirit are a direct continuity. And just as ritual and art are related, that what you do is really who you are. If you want to really define yourself, you can keep an accurate record of what you do. That's really who you are. That's the closest accurate record that you can have. You don't have to have someone else assess you in terms of their valuation, in terms of their professional opinion. You can evaluate yourself. Notice the potency of Benjamin Franklin's little technique. You can notice the freedom of the person. Notice the basis of democracy. You can evaluate yourself with fairly good accuracy. You can come to understand, like it or not, this is really what you really do, and thus this is really who you are. And you can change what you don't like by doing something differently. It's a high mark of civilized freedom to understand you don't have to be the shit you are tomorrow. You can do it differently. If it's hard to stop, well, then just change it a little bit. Do it a little bit differently. If it's hard to stop yelling at someone, try whispering at them. You can say the same thing, but say it in a whisper. It starts to make a difference. And notice, while a real Yogacaran can instantly change himself completely by returning back to the no-self basis, just withdraw every single energy projection. Nothing occurs. Two Zen masters meeting are like two open doors. There's no one there. But in the dog-eat-dog world, where the bottom line is you got to go to work tomorrow, just by doing little things differently actually effectively changes who you are. And you can, by little baby steps, by what sculptors who work in metal have little clamps that take bites out of metal, they're called nibblers. By nibbling at your ironclad structure, you can slowly change yourself, effectively really change yourself, so that tomorrow you'll be different from what you were today, even though it's by a little nibble. But if you keep doing that, the effect and the effectiveness accumulates. This is called, Alfred North Whitehead brought this into play, the phrase is brilliant and beautiful, accumulative penetration. You may not be able to have that lightning Dharma insight and change it now, but everyone can build up the accumulative penetration. And from what I can see, if you persevere for 2 annual cycles, in terms of this planet's nature, 2 years, your accumulative penetration will be enough to spark that access to the deep self so that you can occasionally change everything instantly. You build up a tolerance toward of sensitivity towards acquainting yourself with your own capacities enough so that occasionally you can bring it into play. And you can say, I'm not going to go south, I'm going to go west. I'm not going to yell at those goddamn drivers anymore. And stop. One can even get to the point to where you can catch, I don't know how many nanoseconds it is, but it isn't many, you can catch the very impulse to yell at the drivers and make little cartoons out of that and come out smiling. It's amazing. You can catch temporality and stretch it to any length required and make whatever adjustments you need to make and put it back into play. And though it seems like an instant in this world, it could have been a million years in the adjustment of the spirit. You just take the component out of time space. Adjust it. Put it back into play. It's different. Now it works. Now it works. And the guy who thought you were going to yell at him sees you smiling with genuine compassion. Do you think he's ever going to forget it? He carries your beautiful smile and says, no, it wasn't a grin. It was a smile. Changed him. It's called the law of love. It's quite a law. It works. So when we take out our compass, we see that there's a direct line from science to symbol. There's a continuity from spirit to self. So that the spiritual energy is the self energy. They're the same. They're not distinct. They're differentiable in terms of this world, but in the invisible wholeness of the real, there's no distinction whatsoever. Science and symbol, art and ritual, myth and history, nature and magic, nature naturally blossoms into the magic. That's why fairy tales are true. Myths are culturally relative, but fairy tales are eternally true. That's the difference. Myths only are true in terms of the cultural context in which they expressively occur, but fairy tales are always poignantly thus, no matter where you are. It doesn't matter what cultural tradition you come from, the story of the frog prince is true. And if your little golden ball falls down a well, there's that scenario. Always true. Fairy tales are quite distinctly real. Notice that what becomes real in them is that the imaginative use in fairy tales entails kicking into the memory of your own deep self, which does not occur in mythology. In mythology, the meaning goes towards integration, towards realization. But in fairy tales, one recognizes rather than cognizes. One remembers rather than imagines. Now, I'll just give you a little bit of a caution here. A lot of half-baked New Age teachers talk about creative imagination and disciplining and all that. Hold that in the left hand and make sure that the right hand has something to do. Remember that you have another hand. And while there's a lot of poignancy in the sound of one hand clapping, you want to be able to applaud the author of this world for real. So keep that in mind. I'm not used to making morals out of this, but I know what kind of stew that we have to sup on, and it's a point. Now, we've talked about the philosophy of Niels Bohr, and you can see that in the science sequence, that the last month of the 3 months, the last 4 weeks, is where we should be on this. The reason that I've brought it into play this soon is because most of you have not done your work. You've not been able to convince yourself or to be able to find the molecular biology of the cell or the analog VLSI in neural systems. So I've had to play teacher for you rather than be the teacher in the program that's here. If you don't move in your steps, I can't dance with you. All I can do is be like the old guy at the square dance and call the tune. So instead of us dancing together, you have to just be wallflowers and listen to the tune being called out. But I strongly urge you that there is a dance going on, that it can happen, that you can be asked to dance, and you are being asked to dance, come off the bench, get onto the floor. There's a music playing there, and you might even have some fun at it. I understand that the price of molecular biology of the cell is staggering, what, $33 more? $133 less? $51? Staggering $51. I have a copy here, and I would suggest we have a copy machine here that over the next little while, page through it and just Xerox off, copy off for yourselves at least 10 pages. They don't have to be sequential, but get yourself some pages from that. Try a little movement. It's good for you. Try some, you'll like it. Really. I care for you immensely. I wouldn't do this on any other basis than being with you in a really deep way. Just work on inside appeal. Page through it, and if a page occurs to you, is this a kind of emancy using books? Yeah, and it works. Because on this level, the synchronicities are quite active. What you need to look for is looking for you. Notice the fairy tale element here. What you really need is really needing to find you, too. It will leap out at you. It'll call out to you, I'm for you. It's like the Alice in Wonderland thing. The wafer reads, eat me. The liquid reads, drink me. It's for you. Try 10 pages or so of that. I will Xerox off some pages, I think at least 5 pages from Carver Mead's book for all of you next week. That's available at Caltech. It's about $42. $51. $42. And it sounds like a lot. I hope the $13 doesn't sound like a lot. But what are we doing? We're trying to wake ourselves up to the pristine process that really is occurring for us and with us. The monetary expense is extraneous, actually. It actually is extraneous. Any of you that have had to go through an extensive therapy know that spending $93 is nothing. Absolutely nothing. But we'll try it this other way. And if it works, then I will Xerox some elements out of the next two texts, The Particle Explosion and The Cosmological Distance Ladder. One of them is for the cosmological amplitude, and the other is for the nuclear particle implitude, if I can coin a phrase. That the two go together. The implitude and the amplitude go together. Why do they go together? They go together just like the two diamonds on a Vajra implement go together. They go together because some horizon is holding them in equanimity so that the increasingly small, increasingly large are related together. It's like one of those proofs positive that something in the middle is occurring. And just because you can't hang it on a peg doesn't mean that it isn't occurring. All that not being able to hang it on a peg really means is that it's not peggable. But that it's occurring, there's no way for the amplitude and implitude to be related. What David Bohm's phrase of felicity, wholeness in the implicate order. That the wholeness is happening on polarized scale of this extent shows by exact and precise implication that some hand of comprehension is holding the center and displaying it forth. That realization is profound realization. The proper place in the education pattern for this to occur would have been 6 months ago. The culmination of the symbol section. The culmination of the first year is the place where that should have flashed in, and all of the second year, had that have actually happened, would have been seen in a whole different light. Would have been seen in the Vajrayana, they call it clear light. You would have seen it in clear light. All of this activity would have been seen without shadows, without the sense of perspective that's proper to nature, but with the clarity that is proper of the deep self. When you look at an artistic genius like Kurosaki, you look at a Kurosaki print that's not based on nature. There are no shadows there unless it's there and making sense aesthetically for the composition. Because the referent of that print is the floating world, ukiyo-e. The paradoxical quandaries of the deep self. It isn't an imitation of nature using imagination. It's a remembering of reality from the deep self. If you stare at a Hiroshige long enough in a contemplative mode, you can look up from the print, and wherever you look, you see with Hiroshige's composing eyes. You see the world in his composing eyes. Now, it will fade for you after a while, but it's like an object lesson that you can train yourself to see the real. You don't have to be hypnotized by the natural all the time. There are times when nature is just fine, but there are times when you need to see through it. And one of those times is when you need to come to yourself. You need to see through the appearance. You are not what you see in the mirror. You are not what you see mirrored in your social order, in your cultural mythology. Yes, that is a garment which you can wear. It's in your wardrobe. But you can take that off. You're different from that. You are other from that whole mode. You are a nude radiance undiscovered until you can look through the mirror, through the image. Make the imagination pure, make it transparent. Memory does that. And the art of memory is to purify your images so they do not occur. At least to have had that experience where there's no longer an association, but there is the occurrence itself. It's that great example of, in the Kargyupa tradition, I'll give it to you one more time, and then we'll call it a day. Gampopa, who wrote The Jewel Ornament of Liberation, one of the great spiritual classics of the world, The Jewel Ornament of Liberation. And he was a university professor, the equivalent in Tibet, and he got the calling, as the Protestants would say. He got the calling. The inner self that wanted to be free said, Gampopa. Who? Me? Now? You. So he went to study with Milarepa. Milarepa on the slopes of Mount Everest. Mount Everest is Milarepa's monastery. It still is. Do you think he's dead? So he went there to study with Milarepa. And Milarepa used this tack with him. He said, I want you to come and wake me up in the middle of the night to tell me what dreams you are having. Don't talk to me in the daytime. Why? Because Gyanpopa was intellectually precocious. He was brilliant. His thought functioning was catastrophically brilliant. But he was totally unconscious as to his imagination, to his feeling tone, which is where the ego is. He knew nothing of it. So Gyanpopa, the first night, had a spectacular dream. Complete color, symbols, meaning. Incredible. He woke Milarepa up, told him his dream with glowing eyes and with reverent gestures, and Milarepa said, "That's not it. Go back to sleep." 20-some nights he came, and each night was more spectacular than the next. And each time, he was turned down by Milarepa. Then he had a night where he didn't have any dreams at all, and he thought he'd failed for sure. So he went home. He went back to his place of teaching. He felt that he had just he'd burned out. He had a big chance, and he blew it. And then he heard about 2 or 3 years later that Milarepa had passed on, and he knew in his own ego that that was it. Milarepa was the only teacher who could have brought him through, and he had failed. And over the years, he'd mused on that. And one day he looked up, and he realized that the place where he was teaching had 5,000 students assiduously studying and practicing. And suddenly it occurred to him, he was the master. He was the one. That what Milarepa had passed on to him didn't register in the mind. It didn't register in images. It registered in not needing to have images, in being freed from the necessity of having to have images. That he'd been past the Dharma mind. And that's when he wrote the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, to express his thanks to his teacher for having passed on the no mind in such a compassionate, loving way. He remembered that Milarepa had shown him one time the secret of his yogic practice. Milarepa had stood up and he parted his garment, and he showed him the calluses on his behind. That's the Dharma. What you actually do is important to who you really are. And the real work is to open yourself up enough to let the wind of the Spirit blow through you to wherever it needs to go. And for you to stop putting a little calibration meter on it to charge it thoroughfare fees. For whom are you collecting those fees? You see how it is. Incidentally, Gyanpopa is the originator then of the Karmapas. The person he passed it on to, that no mind, was the first Karmapa. His Tibetan name was Dusum Chemba. Dusum Chemba looked exactly like a monkey. He looked like a human being and a monkey, and he was a thief, a very great thief, not a pickpocket, a big-time thief. And he was extremely formidable and was never caught because he was also a natural telepath. And you, if you're the sheriff of Chamdo, you can't catch a telepathic, ingenious monkey thief. But Gyanpopa caught him because he put the no mind in his mind. When Dusum Chemba read his mind, he read the Dharma. And he stopped stealing. That's enough.